Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 166 for September 21, 2012. Keep on trucking, Ram trucking. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Renzo.
Johnny.
We gather again.
How are you?
There's a lot going on. I've had a great week. How about you?
Good. It's been good. Filling in for you on Autoline Daily.
I loved what you did today. In fact, we got to talk about one of the things that you talked about on Daily today, that Volkswagen ad.
Yeah, yeah.
But we also have to welcome Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press with us tonight.
Oh, thank you, John. Peter.
Yeah. So what have you been up to this week?
Yeah, I've been busy. There's been so much stuff going on in town this week. I mean, there was the unveiling of the new Ford Focus, a chance to drive it.
Fusion.
Fusion, yes. It's the day to get names wrong, I guess.
Well,
Ford Fusion. There was breakfast with GM's head of quality and customer assurance or something like that. And today, presentation on the new Hyundai Santa Fe. So, I mean, there's just all kinds of stuff going on. It's the season for new cars.
It is, in fact, and trucks,
because, yes.
And that's what we should mention to the audience. We have Mike Cairns, the chief engineer on the Ram truck line, who will be joining us later in the show, and we'll talk all about that, too. But, Peter, what do you make of the Fusion?
Well, I wrote about it this week. I mean, it's a defining moment for the Ford Motor Company. It's really the culmination of the years Alan Mulally has been in place, his plan, their vision for where Ford's going to go. And, you know, the Focus is great. Fiesta was great. But I think the Fusion is everything that they've, you know, it's everything they know up till now about how to do a car. And I think it says a lot about the organization and the development of the organization. And, you know, I think it redefines the midsize market. I mean, it's a stunning car. It's a premium car. It can be pricey. But, you know, that's what we're in the business for. I mean, to make money. I mean, profitability. And so, yeah, it's a hugely significant car. Probably the most significant car for Ford in, I don't know, since the original Taurus, you know.
Wow, that's a statement, since the original Taurus. Mark, you've driven the thing, right?
I've driven it. It's very good, and it's gorgeous, as anybody who's seen it, you know, can tell. I have to say, one of the ones that I drove a 1.6-liter EcoBoost, and that engine, more than acceptable, very, very good. I also drove the 2-liter EcoBoost, which is the performance engine, very well loaded, in fact, not well-equipped, loaded titanium version. And the sticker on that was about $37,000, and I find that kind of dismaying for a Fusion. But that will be a tiny proportion of their sales. And I think,
what's the base price of the car?
$22,900.
Yeah,
okay.
Right,
yeah.
In there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The base is a little on the high end of midsize, but not out of touch.
I mean,
at
you should
all.
Be able to get a decent one for, what, 28?
You should, yeah. And they expect the 1.6-liter EcoBoost to be the volume engine. And interestingly enough, all of the complaints that there have been about my Ford Touch, the control system, in the Fusion, if you get anything but the absolute top trim level, you've got a version of the controls that actually has separate dials for tuning and volume.
So they got the message.
But if you go with the top model and you get the Sony sound system, which is a very good sound system, you're stuck with the, you know, kind of flat panel where there's only the one little volume, you know, tuner, and it's a fairly inconvenient one. But that's an aside. The 1.6 is the one they'll sell the most of. You have to figure it'll be priced, you know, competitively.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty serious car. I'd be very surprised if it's not at least, you know, among the finalists, you know, for pretty much all of the awards this year.
Mm. And it's got great presence, design presence on the road, which I mentioned in my column. You know, Bill Mitchell, the famous GM designer in their heyday, was a master at bringing concept car design to the mainstream, you know, and he was just genius at it.
And this gets at that.
And it gets at that. And, you know, it's got great presence on the road. I mean, you know, we say it over and over again. You see the cars under the lights at the auto shows, and you say, oh, yeah, that's cool. And people out in Webville, you know, they see pictures and stuff. But, you know, for us, too, you don't really get it until you see something on the road.
Well, and I was out in L.A. this week driving the Coda electric car. At the same time that Ford was doing the launch of the Fusion in L.A. And at one point, our paths crossed. And I know it because that Fusion popped with all the traffic and everything that you see in L.A. Bang! That car was just, I mean, my eyes were riveted on it. And people are standing around watching it turn the corner and everything like that. So to your point, the car has great presence.
Yeah.
And that's... Unlike the Coda, which just blended into the background.
What was, so what's the story there?
Well, the story on Coda, it's really interesting. You know, when I first saw the car, you know, I was like, bleh, this thing looks terrible. It's a two-generation-old Mitsubishi Lancer, now made in China by a company called Hefei, that, I mean, the Lancer was never anything great to begin with. And I don't know, it's even more bland-looking now. And the build quality, especially the interior fit and finish, I would say is sort of okay. But the electric powertrain part of it is awfully good. So they didn't do what everybody else did and just stuff all the batteries in the trunk. They actually put them under the floor pan of the car. So, I mean, the entire floor pan is batteries, but they've packaged it very well. And that leaves the trunk open, which, you know, I just got out of the Focus EV, which I was knocked out by. I'll get to that in a minute. But it has no trunk room whatsoever. And even in the Leaf and the Volt, it's kind of limited. And because it's all floor pan batteries, they've got more batteries in it than anybody else. So the range is a bit longer. But the performance is what really surprised me. Now, if you're standing at a dead stop and nail it, and you really got to get into someplace, it feels a little bit slow off the line. But once you're rolling, this thing feels terrific. And they're a few thousand dollars cheaper than the other cars out there. The base price is a little over $37,000.
How much does it
weigh? I want to say it's...
3,300?
Oh, no. It's
be close to four.
It's over 4,000 pounds.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And yet, because the center of gravity is so low with all those batteries, it handles quite well.
And the weight is so distributed if they're
very
all the
well
way
distributed
the floor.
And all between that's the axle lines.
But, you know, it looks like a 1985 Nissan Sentra.
Right.
Or
exactly.
A Hindustan. Some old Soviet design.
It does look. It does have a Soviet air about it.
So anybody watching on screen now will see that all these cars going backwards. That was one of the little driving contests they had us do, was driving as fast as you could going in reverse.
By the way, you said standing start. Porsche just released that the 918 plug-in hybrid supercar did a lap at the Nürburgring Nordschleife in 7 minutes and 14 seconds from a standing start.
Whoa. That's hauling.
It's pretty impressive.
That's very impressive.
Yeah,
and again, you know,
you get a lot for your $850,000,
right?
With an extension cord.
Yeah.
And the other thing I noticed with this Coda and with the Focus Electric was, of course, these things have no transmission. So when you're rolling along, like on the freeway, and you want to nail it and get out and pass, there's no kickdown in the transmission. So even though a kickdown is probably a one-second event, the lack of that, I mean, it just goes instantly.
So you like the Focus Electric, right?
Oh, I was super impressed by the Focus Electric.
I've driven it too, but before we move on to the Focus Electric, I've got a Coda question.
Mm-hmm.
How close are they to being able to sell them all around the country?
Not.
Okay.
I mean, I think they've got four dealerships in California right now.
Gotcha.
And this is... So this is what they called their real launch. They've dribbled and drabbled out some info, and they've allowed a few test drives. Somebody did it for the New York Times, for example. But This was their full-blown, here's the production-ready car, go. And now they're going to go to markets where they see EVs selling well. So sure. They've been watching Leaf and Volt like hawks. Yep. And it's just like you'd expect. College towns, it's the Madisons and the Austins yep. and the Ann Arbor. Well, they're not coming to Michigan yet. But it's not
probably
necessarily
New York, New Jersey.
Yes, yeah. Exactly right. D.C.
Sure. Yep.
And that's where they see their market. I think they've got a competitive advantage when it comes to the powertrain. But that car, just, I mean, if I had $40,000 burning a hole in my pocket, I'd go right to the Focus right now if I had to buy an EV.
Well, the Focus is a really good car to start with. Mm-hmm. And with the exception of the trunk, which you're right, I mean, luggage space disappears. But other than that, it's a very good integration of the electric system into, you know, what started out as a really good car. I mean, I thought it was terrific. And one of the things that I found very refreshing is that the software that predicts how far you can drive, probably the most accurate as far as real world matching the prediction that I've seen so far. Mm-hmm. So I would be less likely to get nervous about being stranded, I think, in the Focus than any of the other pure battery electric.
And another thing in both the Focus and the Coda, they have a bigger onboard charger. So it charges a lot faster than the Leaf especially and the Volt.
Yeah.
And that I think helps a lot with range anxiety.
And that'll be a real advantage to the owners. Yeah, because you can charge, I think you can charge the Focus to full in about 4.5 hours if you've got the 240.
Maybe with the 240, yeah. But in any case, it's literally.
And anybody who buys one should have the 240 adapter.
You should.
Yeah.
But I think they're claiming half the time. It takes half the time to charge a Focus as it does a Leaf.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's one of the first things Nissan's going to change, you know, is go with a bigger charger.
And they tweak the design, too, for the Focus.
For the Focus.
Yeah, it looks really good.
Although, you know, when I was driving around, nobody noticed the car.
Yeah. Yeah.
They just didn't. They did change some of the design, but they didn't do anything goofy or, you know.
Some of the lighting is different, if I recall correctly, mm-hmm. but I had the same experience. Nobody realized, except for the fact that it was silent and it snuck up on people and scared them in parking lots. Huh. Nobody realized that it was not just another Focus.
Huh. And the Coda. Just nobody noticed that car. And I thought to myself, geez, to have the newest EV in L.A., and nobody even noticed the car. You know, they need to put like a giant fin on the roof or something like that. But one other thing about the Focus Electric is I let one of my friend's high school daughter drive the car. Now, she has no interest in cars whatsoever. She thinks cars are destroying the planet and they should all be banned. She was knocked out by this Focus EV. She told her mom, oh, we got to get this. This is the car. This is what we got to get. And I thought, how interesting, you know, when we talk all about this new generation, the younger generation, not interested in cars, not getting their driver's license, that here's an 18-year-old who thought that this electric car was the coolest thing that she'd ever been in.
Well, there's hope.
Right.
I'll be dead.
Yeah. Right. Hey, let's talk about that Volkswagen ad, Peter, because on today's Daily, you really shouted that out as one of the best TV ads for a car company ever.
Well, it's crept up on people. They just started running it literally a few days ago. And you know, every once in a while, since I was in the ad biz for 22 plus years, you know, I take more than a casual interest in it. Every once in a while, an ad comes out of, like a bolt out of the blue, and it's just so it resonates so deeply, and it captures people who don't really care about advertising's attention. And the thing about it is, there's no car in it. All it is people from all age groups, races, what have you, laughing and smiling through the whole spot. And it has a wonderful line at the end, which I don't have in front of me. But it's just a magical spot.
I think the tagline, something like, it's not the miles, it's how you live them.
I've got it in my phone. But, yeah, talk amongst yourselves while I look at it.
Well, the other thing is apparently they crowdsourced all these video clips of everybody laughing.
Yeah, they're all real people.
So, Ben, what's the name of that website?
There you go. We just got the slogan. It's not the miles, it's how you live them.
Yes.
There you go. There you go. It's Pop something or other. Pop Starter? I'm not getting it right. But anyway, pardon?
Kickstarter.
Kickstarter. Thank you. But anyway, apparently they mined that site for all different scenes of people laughing. So it's literally, this is not an agency, is my understanding, that went out and shot this.
Well,
they crowdsourced the video.
Deutsche LA did it. Another interesting backstory is Kevin Mayer, who Joel Wanick hired to be a GM, who basically had a cup of coffee there before rejoining his buddy at Volkswagen, was behind it. It's just, and it's 30 seconds. It's not overwrought. It's not.
And
how do they connect it with the car, though? I mean, it's the people smiling, being happy. It's just, not the, is it just the logo?
It's just the line at the end with the little VW.
And okay. It says something like, that's the power of German engineering or something to that effect?
Yeah, I've got it here.
I've only seen the ad once, and I only saw half the ad.
It's not the miles, it's how you live them. That's the power of German engineering.
Okay. And no car in the ad at all?
None.
Now, I've seen car companies do public service announcements, you know, we're saving the planet kind of approach where they don't show cars. But I've never seen a brand out to polish its brand image and never show a car in it.
Well, the only it can go wrong, like Infiniti found out when they launched their brand.
Right, the rocks and trees.
Yeah, and you know, actually, when you think back between the two cars, the Q45 was much more of a driver's car. And it was a serious car.
Yep.
And the Lexus was obviously a Mercedes of that era copy. But, you know, the Infiniti as a potential, like an enthusiast machine, had a lot more to offer. And that's an example of it really didn't work.
But the Volkswagen ad works because it is so compelling. Yeah. You know, when the ad came on, my wife and daughter had the TV on. I was doing something. I wasn't really paying attention. And that ad came on. Finally, I had to look and go, what the hell is this about?
And the other backstory of it was the thinking behind it was, they know that we are going to be inundated with political advertising for the next 7 weeks. And they thought, you know what, maybe it'd be nice to just give everyone a break. And, you know, it's just damn near genius.
Obviously now Volkswagen is trying to move from being the sort of, you know, niche brand that they've been to speak to a much wider
Absolutely.
Audience. Is this part of their play to try to get on the screen of more people, just raise awareness?
Well, you know, I guess that didn't hurt, but it didn't seem like the overwhelming thing, you know, impetus behind it. I think they just wanted to do it. Does it play into the fact that they are much more a mainstream brand? Yes. But I think, you know, once in a while, if you're on the client side, You want to see an idea like that. And if you have the gumption and you can sell it through and it makes it to the screen untouched, it will have the most impact. So I applaud the people who were behind it because I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, my read of it was that they just want people to see the ad and feel good about Volkswagen. Just say, that's so good, I feel good about that.
Yeah,
brand.
Because it's feel good, and then it's just like, oh, Volkswagen, it's kind of like, oh, that's kind of nice. And that's all you need. That's all you need. As an advertiser, you know, you can lay out, we're going to, you know, this market, strategic, this, that. All you need is someone to have a good thought about your brand, and that's what this does. Real simple. If it gets someone to maybe, you know, let's go on the internet. I'm thinking of getting a new car. Maybe I'll check out Volkswagen. That's all you need.
Then another brand-related issue, the Delta Wing race car,
yes.
Which Nissan got behind for the same thing, to make people feel good about that brand.
Yeah, well, the Delta Wing, the American car companies had a shot at it, and they declined. It was a one-off deal, which is, I think, really why they declined it, because no one knew where it was going. Ran at Le Mans, acquitted itself very well, ran with the P2 cars, and then got punted off by one of the Toyota prototypes. And, you know, the program was dead. But now it's coming to Petit Le Mans in October. It'll be the only time that American race fans can see it in person. Whether it lives beyond that, I don't know. Now, ALMS and Grand Am are merging, and the prototype class is going to be the Grand Am DPs, ALMS LMP2s, and the Delta Wing, because Don Panos owns the Delta Wing. So he's going to make sure that they somehow make it competitive, which that's a hell of a task. But anyway, it's good to see that we're going to be able to see the Delta Wing in person at Road Atlanta in October.
And maybe see it finish a race instead of being taken out in the curve.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was running quite well at Le Mans.
It did. They had a niggling little problem. A solenoid, I think, in the transmission went out, and it was there were other cars with that same transmission in it, with that same kind of solenoid that didn't have the problem. So I think they lost like 10 laps or something like that trying to get that fixed.
And well, then, you know, inside baseball, they never had the proper gearbox for the car. Hmm. They found out a problem early on, and they never got it in the car for the race. So I think that's – I don't know if that's – I think it's rectified for Petit Le Mans.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
But to your point, Mark, yeah, it ran quite well when it was running.
And it's just so – it's nice to see something that is that different. And not just in the engineering, but in the visual impact of
it.
Yeah. There's nothing else. You've never seen anything like that on a race track.
And let's not forget, the original concept was to be the next generation IndyCar.
Right.
And, you know, they went all conservative, although that would have been really something if it was the new next generation.
It would have transformed the series.
Yes, it would have. So it was languishing in limbo, and they Ben Balby, the designer, and Duncan Dayton, the Highcroft Racing, said, you know, maybe we could adapt it to ALMS. So they did.
I'm glad they did. But let's hope it goes beyond that, too. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what kind of crowd reaction, media reaction that the car gets.
Yeah, half the weight, half the horsepower, half the aerodynamic drag, and I don't know.
Half the fuel consumption.
Yeah, half the fuel consumption, if not a little better than that. Mm-hmm. So,
well, why don't we take a quick commercial break, and then let's get Mike Kearns from Ram Truck. I almost said Dodge Ram again. It's going to take years to get me trained to say it right, but Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone.
Yeah, there we go.
So, Mike Kearns, welcome to After Hours.
Well, thank you.
So I had that right. You're the chief engineer, the vehicle line engineer. You're some sort of engineer.
Well, the title is vehicle line executive, but it used to be chief engineer, but now we've got chief engineers for the 1500, for the 3500 pickup, and then for the 35, 45, 5500 chassis cabs. So I have the kind of head of Ram engineering, if you will.
And maybe some others that you can't quite talk about now?
There might be some other things in our future that we'll be happy to come back and talk about.
Now, we'll get into this truck that we got here in the studio, too, but I'm just curious right off the bat. What about a Dakota-size pickup, a smaller, compact pickup? Anything like that in the future?
We're absolutely looking at it, but nothing to announce. But we certainly think there's a market for a more mid-sized truck, but it's got to be great fuel efficiency. And that's what I think happened to that market in the past, right? That market has shrunk to near nothing because no one, including ourselves, offered a really great fuel economy package.
Well, the only
they
reason
went from being clearly much smaller to mid-sizes that were almost as big as the full sizes. I mean, is that a differentiation that could work again? Or do you need to have really obvious steps between vehicles if you're going to bother doing a second one?
Yeah, I think you need more of a step there. That was a mistake we had made. We grew the Dakota. Dakota was a great truck.
And it was the first one that kind of stepped up to midsize, and everybody followed because
we did very well for a while, right? But it was when fuel prices were quite low. We had a great 4.7 V8 in there that did great power, and it was a great capable truck for a little bit less money and a little bit better fuel economy. It was a good proposition at the time. But what happened with fuel prices going up, the great 1500 that we launched in 2009 that brought a very capable truck with actually even better fuel economy at a great price point. And it really made the Dakota not really fit a niche any longer.
The only reason I wanted to ask you that right off the bat is I wish I had a dollar for all the mail, for every email that we get saying, why don't they build a compact truck? I don't want a big one. there's a lot of people out there that seem to like a smaller pickup.
Sure. We hear that, and we're looking into it.
Okay.
So give us an overall picture of the truck market. I mean, you know, we're in this business, but I don't know as if the listeners or the viewers have any idea how important the truck market is to the overall U.S. automobile industry, important to you guys and obviously Ford and GM. How big is it?
Well, it's enormous, right? And it did shrink. It contracted during, you know, the dark times here in the U.S., but it's been coming back strong. If you look top-selling vehicles, number one and two are pickup trucks, and we're number four. So we're right there. It's huge.
And very profitable.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
What's the overall size of the market right now?
It's about 1.5 million units, but it varies month to month, but it's been growing steadily since we've all come out of the rough times.
What the big collapse, as I call it.
The Great Recession, yes.
And your forecasters are saying that you can expect it to remain steady and grow over the next year or so?
Yes, we see some growth, but we're also going after market share. So, and as you've seen in the Ram market share, we've gained over 5% market share in the last couple of years.
So we've been doing extremely well. It's hit the dealers already?
It's just going out. We've started production, but like we do in many launches, we contain those vehicles till we are sure the quality is there. It's what we've done in the last many launches now at Chrysler to assure we have great quality once that first truck hits the dealership. So
people have not seen, by and large, the truck that we have here in the studio.
That's
with
correct.
Us.
Yes. Well, you know, we had a reveal at the New York Auto Show, and other than that, there has been no public display. Other than my driveway.
and it's been a quick turnaround, too, because the last one you did as an all-new truck as an 09 model, right? So it was kind of just as the credit crisis hit and everybody was just hanging on for dear life. Nobody was buying trucks, and then, you know, bankruptcy and everything else happened. So you kind of launched off the edge of a cliff almost, and now you've got a very substantial set of changes, given that it's only been, you know, 4 years since then.
Right. It's really part of the aggressive nature of the new Chrysler. We really saw the market potential, felt there were some things we needed to do to the truck, fuel economy being the number one, and we went after it very aggressively. Technology is the other thing, of course, the infotainment systems, huge growth, right?
Even with truck buyers.
Absolutely. You know, the truck market spans from our entry-level vehicles, about just over $23,000.
The work truck.
Right. A great tradesman package, right? V8, six-speed, beautiful truck. All the way up to our Laramie Longhorn, which is the decked-out...
This is the full zoot suit.
Correct. Yeah. The full zoot suit. That's good. And this, you know, can mid-40s it starts at and goes up from there. So huge span of customers. And when you go to Texas, which I was trying to get Mark to join us, the market in Texas is incredible. You've got guys with, you know, big horse trailers with campers in the front. These are $250,000 campers with $100,000, $200,000 horses in the back. So the $60,000 truck to tow it.
That's the cheapest part.
Exactly. Yeah. So they want everything.
Now, you know, I would have thought that a truck buyer is a lot more conservative and would have said, I don't want me no touch screen or nothing like that. So I'm surprised to hear you say infotainment's like one of the key things for this truck.
Well, again, it's a broad market. So we still have an entry-level radio, which has two dials and AM, FM, and that's about it.
And big enough dials you can wear gloves. And
absolutely, yes. You remember that. Back from our 1994 launch when we really did a big improvement in the truck. We said made sure guys with gloves can touch and feel all the knobs, etc.
And that's not just the base truck, if I remember right. If you go with the full boat, you know, totally loaded, you know, impress the Texas neighbors, you've got the touch screen, but you also still have dials that are big enough that if you're working, if you've got gloves on, you can still work the other stuff. So it's not a sort of a My Ford Touch situation where people can't access some features. Is that right?
That absolutely. As we launched the Uconnect infotainment system in the 2011 Charger 300 and Journey, it's won a lot of awards. Because of that, we have redundant, we call them hard controls, meaning real knobs, real buttons down below, but there's also the soft touch, which is the buttons on the screen, the touch screen. We continued that and took it to another level on the truck because there are trucker truck guys who want buttons. So we have a great switch bank with all of the heated seat controls, heated steering wheel, cooled seats, etc. So there are hard buttons.
So is this the top of the line right here?
That's it. Yes, that is. Laramie Longhorn.
Look at that emblem on the side. Wow.
That's about as big a badge as I've ever seen on a truck that says Longhorn Ram. What's that, 1500?
Correct.
And it's about as shiny as it gets, too.
Make a nice belt buckle for you.
And we've got Craig doing something interesting. He's got his phone, and we're streaming live through his phone right now. Craig, take a look at the floor mats. And, Mike, you got to tell us about this, because he said built into the floor mat is actually a belt buckle?
Yes. Well, the same mold that makes that plate. So you see the metal plate. Mm-hmm. That is a true cast metal plate. The guy who designed this, Ryan Negotti, who did the awesome interior in this truck, planned to have that so it is shaped to be a belt buckle. You glue on the buckle part and you're off and running.
And look at that thing. I mean, that looks good. It doesn't look cheap or anything.
No, that's the attention to detail.
I feel bad about stepping on it.
Yeah.
Really.
Actually, we talked about that. And the kind of look it is in a Laramie Longhorn, you scuff it up, it actually looks better. It looks worn, looks Western.
Looks real.
Exactly.
And I love the leather interior that you've got in there. I mean, it looks like saddle leather and the stitching, big fat stitching
right.
on it.
Well, thanks. We're very proud of that. We really went to the high-end grain leathers for the Longhorn. And now we brought that also into the Laramie. The beautiful leather seats are a much higher grade leather in the 2013 Laramies now.
That was kind of pioneered by Ford when they did the
King Ranch,
yeah, right?
Yeah. And while the camera's in there, I saw real briefly an image of the shifter control. And probably most people haven't seen that. And, you know, so completely new. You got rid of the console mounted, no more on the column. You've got that rotary.
That's right. With the new 2013s, we're introducing the 8-speed transmission. We've named it Torque Flight 8 for the old Mopar folks.
Nice.
Oh, that's cool.
We love that name.
That's cool.
It's a transmission made by ZF, fantastic 8-speed transmission. That's one of the key enablers to the big fuel economy gains we've made that we've now achieved by far best in class, 18 mile per gallon city, 25 highway.
So
and a 21 combined.
That's with the 1500 rear wheel drive.
That's correct. That's with the Pentastar, the 3.6,
right?
Which I'll tell you is just a fantastic powertrain. It's what I'm driving right now. It's got best in class horsepower, 305 horse, best in class fuel economy, 1825, best in class tow rating at 6500 pounds, and the best in class performance, 0 to 60 times, 7.5 seconds. It's a really capable powertrain. We're really proud of that. Now, also launching in January, we'll be bringing that great 8-speed behind the Hemi. So you get a Hemi Torque Flight 8, fantastic powertrain. We're confident we'll also get best in class in the V8 category. The other wonderful thing, so with that, and I got off topic, the shifter, because it's a fully electronic controlled transmission, you can't have a standard gated shifter. Right, and you've
or
seen
you don't
this.
Need to have one anyway.
Well, you don't need one, yeah. But it also because we're able to control gears and control park mode, etc. A fixed shifter just doesn't work, and you've seen that in other offerings with full electronic transmissions by some of the European automakers. They have what's called a monostable shifter, so the shifter always finds this. BMW has this, goes to a center neutral point. It's in a truck; it just didn't fit the image. Plus, we have a lot of column shifts where we have a bench seat. So we needed a solution that worked for both a column shift, a floor shifter, and would work with an electronic transmission. So we did a lot of research and found the knob is the most intuitive. Everybody jumps in. It says park, reverse, neutral, drive, right? It immediately understandable. And the other thing we liked is it's blind operation. You don't have to look at it to know what gear. We've got big detents, a great solid feel, and we've had great response also. And then it opens up the center console area for a lot of storage.
Hmm. So is this total clean sheet or is there any carryover from the prior truck?
There is some carryover, but it's substantial. We really touched every system. So the we'll call it steel suspension is more or less carryover, right? But we upgraded the chassis. The frame has more 50 KSI steel to reduce weight. We've, on the 4x2, we went to aluminum lower control arms to save weight. So even on a more or less carryover, we made some substantial changes. And then on top of that, we bring in the air suspension, which is entirely new chassis and just absolutely fantastic. I think we shocked the industry. You guys can confirm that, but...
We're shocked.
And yes, I thought
and that's rear suspension only.
No. Nope. Four-corner.
Four-corner.
We had a big advantage. First off, we still are the only four-corner coil spring suspension pickup truck in the market. We did that back in 2009, went the rear suspension, dropped the leaf springs, and went to a great coil spring link coil suspension. Because of that, as our brethren, Jeep brethren, launched the air suspension in the Grand Cherokee, we went, hey, that'll work on our truck. So we worked with our Jeep friends, had some of their engineers come over to my team, worked with the same supplier and developed that system, really adapted that system to the truck.
But totally different platforms. I mean,
Yes, but the same idea. It's the same. We had to upgrade for the truck duty cycle, of course, but it's the same basic parts. The control systems are the same. The electronic controls are the same. The pump in the rear is the same. We have different reservoirs, and then the bladders themselves are beefed up for truck usage.
So with the air suspension, when you load up the back, the truck will still be flat. It's not going to be dragging its tail.
That's right. Yes, auto load leveling, and then there are four customer selectable ride heights. The park mode, entry exit mode. So
because these things are kind of tall.
Oh yeah. And I actually had a great opportunity. My had relatives over and some older people. Right, and I had my truck, lowered it down, took them for a ride. They were able to get in and out wonderfully. And then I mentioned to you earlier, picked up a boat. And I actually
Tell that story. That's a good
I put
one.
It in park mode, backed up to the trailer, lined it up using the camera,
right.
And then pushed it in off-road 2 mode, so it raised up and automatically coupled the trailer, and I drove off.
Never had to get
cool.
out of it.
Yeah. Right. Not that we recommend that, but it's kind of cool.
And then at highway speeds, it lowers the
Correct.
Truck, right?
Also drops into aero mode, just like the Grand Cherokee. So there's a normal ride height, it drops down to entry exit, and then there's 2 off-road modes that are selectable.
So when you drop it into highway mode, what kind of coefficient of drag does it have versus, you know, in its normal mode?
Right. It's about another 1, 2% improvement in aerodynamics. You guys know, the fuel economy is huge. So every little percentage we've been chasing, it's a big deal. We actually have best-in-class aerodynamics without the air suspension. We achieved a 0.36 CD, which is phenomenal for a pickup truck.
For a pickup, yeah.
We already were best-in-class, and we're now even better without air suspension. Hmm. So when you drop it another inch, that's real-world fuel economy to the customer.
Now, the tonneau cover is part of the way that you get that lowest CD, though, right?
No.
Really?
Actually,
that's without with the bed open.
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah. Because that's not standard.
Okay.
So
does the tonneau cover really help aero-wise?
Absolutely.
Huh.
It makes a significant difference. So part of we have a high fuel efficiency package, which does include the tonneau cover, and that does improve the real world. But we actually got the EPA ratings without the tonneau cover. Okay. Mentioning that, this is now an OEM designed tonneau cover, factory installed. So our team designed it. It's factory warranted. It's much more durable than the stuff out in the marketplace. So,
well, and when I was testing one of the vehicles, I've got to say it's very easy to put it on and off, and it's broken up into 3 pieces, so you can just open the rear third and flip it forward if you like. So it strikes me as one that if it was my truck, I'd be much more likely to just leave it on all the time because the truck is not a whole lot less usable.
Right.
With it.
We want to encourage people to do that for sure. It does make a big difference in your fuel economy. So leave your tonneau covers on if you have one.
What about dropping the tailgate?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Mythbusters proved that that was not good for fuel economy, and they're right. We've known for years in our wind tunnel, we've tested that, and we've tested Ford, Chevy, other trucks. Everybody's the same. Tailgate down is worse for aerodynamics, so leave your tailgate up. It also hurts durability because the beds are designed, when that tailgate's up, it locks, ties everything together. So you actually hurt your durability and your fuel economy.
So what's next down the road? And what I'm getting at is CAFE standards. I mean, even though you're best in class now, it's still not going to be good enough by the end of the decade.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So there is no stopping. We're very proud of what we've done, but we cannot stop. So there is no pause in this industry anymore. We're moving on. So I can't share any details, but we're absolutely have other things coming to improve fuel economy for both the light-duty truck as well as the heavy-duty and the chassis cab trucks. That market's important. Total cost of ownership, we talk about, is a big deal, and we're working on improvements for that market as well.
Where do you see the next big gains coming, lightweighting or powertrain?
Every aspect, quite honestly. Just like we did with this truck, right? We brought in great, efficient powertrain with the Pentastar Torque Flight 8, but we didn't stop there. We also have we call transthermal management. We use a heat exchanger to warm up the trans fluid. We have active grill shutters that actually close off the front of the grill. Behind the beautiful grill, just closes off the airflow. Pulse width modulation controls of the fuel pump and the fan to reduce energy usage.
Wait, you got to explain that. What do you mean? Pulse width.
Pulse width I don't modulation. Know. PWM.
PWM.
Our brand guys love that. They talk about PWM. It's pulse width modulation. Normally, you run in a fuel pump, you just turn on 12 volts and it runs. Same thing with cooling fan, you provide 12 volts and it runs at a certain RPM. Pulse width modulation, you pulse 12 volt at a certain frequency to run the pump at whatever speed you want, the pump or the cooling fan. Every time you're not pulsing is you're preserving energy. So it's not a new invention in the industry, but we've applied it to both the fuel pump and the cooling fan. Again, another little piece, little increment of fuel economy gain. And when you do all of these little things, it adds up to significant savings. So you ask about the future. What is it? There is no it. It is everything. It is touching weight, more efficient powertrains, looking at alternatives. We just launched a compressed natural gas heavy duty, the 2500, right? That's a great technology, you know, available in abundance in North America. We think there's a great market for that if we can get the infrastructure behind it in the U.S.
But also the cost. I mean, those things are outrageously priced. They add like what, $6,000 to the price of the vehicle or something like that?
9 to 10, but that's less than a hybrid electric system.
For a truck, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, because. But why is the CNG stuff so expensive?
Oh, well, it's just the tanks are the biggest expense, right? So you do have to have a tank capable of handling certain pressures, and you have to mount them and package them in an area where they'll be safe and an impact, and, of course, durable long term. And then you've got high-pressure valves, et cetera, regulators. So there are expenses, but those would come down as volumes go up. Right now, it's very low volume. Mm-hmm. As we increase volume, those prices will come down. We'll find suppliers to build the parts at cheaper cost. We've got a great partner with Fiat, of course, right? They are the leading producer of CNG in Europe. So
the world.
Yeah, the world, right. So we brought them in. They really helped us out to design this system, and it's been working great. We're just launching that also. Very limited market right now because of infrastructure, but it's another solution. It's not the solution, but it's another great solution out there.
And as well as infrastructure, one of the drawbacks that CNG vehicles have had in the past is that storage takes up more space, mm-hmm. is heavier, and effectively that leads to a lesser range. What kind of range have you got, all tanks full in the heavy duties that you're building now?
Right. Well, we were able to package enough tanks, and you rate them in gasoline gallon equivalent, GGE, and it's a 18.2 gallon, I think, gasoline gallon equivalent, which equates to about a 250-mile range in CNG. Coupled with that, we actually have a bi-fuel system, which is part of what we got out of the Fiat, our Fiat team.
That's what they're very best at.
Right. And that's a great package. So it's really a hybrid. It's a gasoline CNG hybrid. And we package a small 8-gallon gasoline tank that has another 155-mile range. So together, that's a very normal full-size truck range. We also do make available the full 35-gallon gasoline tank, which would give you over 700-800-mile range.
And diesel too? You still have that Cummins diesel or
what?
Oh,
absolutely.
Okay.
No secret, we love the Cummins diesel as our customers do. It's been a great partnership for 29 years, something like that. Very long time.
One of the things that we always get questions about, though, are people who like diesels love diesels, and the question keeps coming up, why no diesels in light-duty trucks? As the fuel economy standards become more stringent, is that something that we're more likely to see? What's the state of the art there?
Well, it's a great question. Diesels are certainly one of the things we're looking at for light-duty solution. The handicap is they are more expensive. The diesel engine itself is expensive. And then to meet U.S. emission requirements, we now are forced to go to these urea systems, the selective catalyst reduction. So you have to carry urea tanks. You have to have heated lines, heated tank. It brings a lot of expense and some complexity. All very doable, but when you add all those costs up, in a light-duty market, it's a difficult sell. In heavy duty, because you get the tremendous capability out of it, it's a much easier sell. In the light duty market, though, you're not really selling capability, you're doing it for fuel economy. So the
and
business
for the amount
proposition.
Of money you'd be spending, there are other things that you can bring in, more lightweight materials, other powertrain things.
Right. So it's still something we're looking at. Diesels are a great answer, but we got to work on the expense.
Okay, we got to give our viewers a shot at asking you questions too. So we got to get to the rapid fire segment. But Ben, before we do that, let's give a shout out to our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh no, that's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Okay, Mike, this is the part that we call rapid fire where we get to the questions from the audience. Ben, let it rip. Okay, the first question that comes up here is from Dennis. He says, with the all-new electronic transmissions, are there any plans to bring back a push-button shifter? He says his old Dodge Dart in 1962 had it, and it was very cool.
Excellent question. We definitely looked at the push button because of our historical linkage to that. We clinicked it, and I'll be blunt and honest, the knob, the rotary knob that we went with clinicked better. People found it a little more intuitive, and the blind operation portion was a big advantage. You don't have to look at it to be able to find the gear you want. But we still love those old Dodges and Chryslers with the push button.
Rum and Coke wants to know, or he says, I don't think the Ram box is available on the heavy-duty pickups. How come? And what do you mean by the Ram box, Terry?
Oh, great question. Thanks for asking. The Ram box is an invention we launched in the 2009 Ram truck. We actually take the bed of the pickup, where the wheel wells come in, the wheel wells are about 49 inches across, so you can put a normal piece of building material in, but then the wheel wells cut out and there's a bunch of more or less dead space in the bed of a standard pickup truck. What we did is at that 49 inch created walls and then covered those with the Ram box and created a storage space in each side of the bed of the pickup. Substantial storage space. So enough to hold 10 cases of beer, I'm told.
That's an important statistic.
So to the question, though, yes, we do offer Ram box and heavy duty now. We launched that last year in the 6-foot 4-inch box, which is about 90% of our take. We now have a Ram box offered. So it's in all but 8-foot box and dually versions that we have the Ram box now.
Okay, Coacher 12 wants to know, what kind of mileage would the truck get when pulling 8,000 pounds? Ballpark figure.
Well, that's a tough question. It depends where in the country, which powertrain. But, you'll be in the – it drops significantly, of course, with a load. But I will say, when we get our Hemi with the power
– Torque Flight 8.
Thank you.
Even I know that now.
It will get substantially better fuel economy than a EcoBoost.
Okay, wants to know more details about the 8-speed box. What kind of gear ratios?
Well, it actually has the first gear ratio is a 4.71, which is one of the reasons that
a creeper gear, just about.
It's fantastic. So you start out with a much lower gear. Our standard is about a 3.5, I think, in a six-speed. So that's a big gear advantage in first gear. When we couple that with the 3.6, which is a great motor, but of course it is a V6 with 269 foot-pounds of torque, but you're able to couple that with that great first gear to really get tremendous launch, as well as power for towing, which is one of the reasons we're able to hit a best-in-class tow rating.
So with the V6 in eighth gear at 70 miles an hour, what kind of RPM are you turning?
About 2,000 RPM. So final gear is actually about the same. Where you really get the advantage is the efficiency shifting, in first gear for launch, as well as the efficiency of the gear space, the gear spread.
Scott wants to know, have you been able to narrow down what percentage of your half-ton buyers actually tow or put cargo in the bed on a regular basis?
It's a good question, and we have done a fair amount of research on this. I don't recall the exact numbers, but a 1,500 customer is very different than a 2,500, 3,500. They do not tow and haul nearly as often, but they're more weekend towers and haulers. It's more of a personal use truck. So during the week, they're air haulers, right? But on the weekends, they hook up the big boat, the snowmobile trailer. They're getting a load of drywall from Home Depot, things like I do. And it really is a more occasional user. But when they want it, they want a very capable truck.
From a larger perspective, how and where does Ram do most of your market research?
Oh, we go all over the country, but I will say Southwest is certainly a dominant market for pickup trucks. Texas, no doubt, is one of the areas that is a very strong market. But we don't just look at Texas. We go northeast, southeast, Denver, the mountain regions are very important also. Different area, different usage.
Here's a few more.
I can't leave out my Canadian friends also. We actually do. We've been up to Alberta and done some research up there.
Got to test in Canada for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Here's more questions about diesels. Like I said, I wish I had a buck for every time one came in here. Same one. You already addressed it, though. Why not in the light duty? And here C-Tech is asking, what about a four-cylinder diesel for the 1500?
Yeah. Well, it again comes down to cost. It's a cost proposition. If we can find the right balance of the cost of a diesel, it's got to be capable, though. Right, it's still a full-size pickup truck, so we need some reasonable capability and the right price point that we'd be able to make a good business case.
Okay, here's a question that goes back to our Ford Fusion discussion. So, Peter, I'll throw this to you, and Mark, you can jump in. He says the 1.6-liter EcoBoost, did it have auto stop-start?
Yes, the one I drove did. That is a separate option on the vehicle. It's about a $300 option.
$250, I think.
Something
I
in
thought,
that ballpark.
I thought that's what I remember.
Yes, it did. It worked very well. The stop was virtually unnoticeable. When it started again, you could tell that it had, but it was quick. It was infinitely better than the BMW stop.
Well, everything's better than
that's
the BMW
very true.
One that,
yes.
that we've talked about,
yes.
right?
It was pretty good. It was pretty good.
Well, you anticipated his question because he wanted to know exactly how you thought that was. Peter, have you experienced the stop-start?
Yeah, I think it's excellent. I mean, it's probably even a little better than the 911.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, remember when we had Dan Knapp on the show who ran, I don't know if it's run or ran because I know he's going to be retiring soon, but he was talking about how they do, I want to say, four pulses of the fuel injection so that the thing starts smoother instead of the big, sledgehammer effect that you get with the BMW.
Interesting.
So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, the thing about the 911 is, in fairness, the motor's right there, so you hear more of it.
Yeah.
Now, when you're in the Panamera, you don't hear as much, but the Fusion's still better.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though. One of the things I've heard from people at a couple of other companies is that it's a little bit easier to do it smooth in a transverse engine mounting than it is in a longitudinal, because it's just where are the vibrations being directed, and that makes it simpler for the Chevy Eco, the Malibu Eco, and the Fusion. But the Panamera is excellent, and the S Class is one that I think has a very good stop start as well.
And the Ram 1500, we are also launching stop start with the HFE, the high fuel efficiency package.
So are you charging separate for the stop-start, or is that just part of that whole package?
It's part of this HFE package.
And what's that package
cost? So it's a model.
Cost?
It's, you know, I'm sorry. I don't know the number offhand, but it'd be in the mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice package, and that includes stop-start technology.
Mm-hmm.
We've limited it to that.
Oh, and the HFE is not a package that you can just get on.
It's a model.
I couldn't get it on the Longhorn here. It's a separate model.
It's a separate model. Yeah.
But I got to believe, going forward, stop-start's going to be on everything?
Well, it is one of those technologies that does provide about 1 mile per gallon city improvement. But customer acceptance is a concern because of what Mark talked about. The stops are very smooth. The restarts, you do feel and hear it. A body-on-frame vehicle, though, gives us a little bit of advantage because we have an extra level of isolation.
Mm-hmm.
So we think we've done an excellent job with it, certainly better than the BMW also. We have benchmarked that one.
Yeah, well, you notice they have a button where you can turn it off.
Right. Yes.
So if you don't like it.
Yes. We do also for a customer who may not want it.
As does the Fusion.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I would guess that everybody who offers that will have the button.
Hmm.
But to get the credit from the EPA for the extra mile a gallon, the default has to be that it starts
that it
off
on.
In the on.
Correct.
Correct. When you key off. Yeah. That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, when will your stop start be available?
We launch in October with that, that model. Yeah. Right.
And Porsche, you know, if you engage the sport button, stop start doesn't come on, which makes sense.
That makes total sense. Hey, Ben, I see we got some questions from our phone friends coming in. Let's bring in the first phoner.
Hi. Hi, this is Andrew Libera from North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Just want to say, John and Peter, you guys are doing an awesome job. Love watching the show. My question goes to Mike for Ram. Now, as we know, Ram is now doing the 1500, 2500, 3500 pickup trucks. Is there any chance that Ram will be going into other vehicles, such as maybe SUVs, or is Ram going to stick strictly with just pickup trucks?
Thank you. Good question.
Good question. The answer is Ram is the pickup truck brand, also the chassis cab and commercial truck brand. So sport utilities are not in that marketplace. I would not anticipate we would go there ever. That is the Jeep. Jeep is our sport utility brand primarily. Ram is, pickup trucks and commercial vehicles.
But you got a Dodge Durango, although that's off the Grand Cherokee chassis.
Correct, yeah.
But you would think that, you know, I thought car companies were all about making money. That's what you said early in the show, Peter. Couldn't you guys, I mean, it would just seem to be a great way to take a terrific chassis that you got here and make more money off it.
Never know, but I can't. Sergeant, now I got to give you the corporate line. Yeah, can't comment on future product.
Sergeant Schultz defense.
Yeah, right.
I know nothing.
Let's see. Does CAFE include only 1500 series pickups, or does it go further and include bigger trucks as well?
CAFE only goes up to 1500. When we get into heavy duty, we're over 8500 pound GVW. But there is now new fuel economy standards coming for the heavy-duty pickup and even chassis cab.
Oh, yeah. When's
but
that start?
But they're separate. It's not locked in yet, but it's out in 16, 17 model year-ish. It's not locked in, but we're paying close attention and, of course, talking good contact with the EPA on that.
Rich wants to know, any impact with your customers when you switched from Dodge to Ram?
That is a good question. Like you did earlier, and I do occasionally, we still refer to it as a Dodge Ram.
It just trips off the tongue so easily.
We have such a great history of Dodge Ram that we don't really want to suppress that either, and don't chastise anyone, especially the host of the show, for making that.
Co-host.
Sorry, co-host. Yeah. But at the same time, the separation of the two was really quite important to the Dodge car brand. Ram trucks so overpowered the image of Dodge that it was hard to market the Dodge cars. So the separation, Ram trucks